You've tuned in to the Round Table Podcast, episode 18. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week on the Roundtable Podcast, we invite writers to come on the show and pitch their story ideas to Dave and I and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it. We talk about it. We explore ideas, strengths, weaknesses, plot, theme, arc, environments, world, all of it. We dig froth and sputter a great deal. Hopefully distilling the raw essence of the idea down into that much exalted element, literary gold.
That's right.
How you doing, Bri?
I'm good.
We missed you last week, dude.
I know. I'm sorry. It was
you were up in the mountains running naked with twigs in your hair, right?
Yes, yeah, something similar to that. My dad and I we do an annual fishing derby. And it just happened to fall on that particular day, and there was no way of getting out of it because it's only once a year, you know.
Sure.
And,
sure.
But we ended up. I caught I think 18 fish, and he caught.
Holy crap!
I think he probably caught 25, but I'm gonna say that he caught 17 because you know
that's less than you
than me.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But so, he uses two poles.
So you're the fisher king, and he's the fisher prince.
We were pretty neck and neck the whole time. It was a good time. We did really well.
Did you win?
So, no. Most of the fish that we caught. See, here's the problem. He went fishing in the exact same spot, like 2 days before that, and he caught like a 3-pound rainbow trout, right? Which is like unheard of, and it's the biggest fish he's ever caught in his life. So he got that 2 days before the derby, instead of waiting. And then catching it the day of the derby so that we could win. But no, we didn't even go weigh in the fish. We just had a good time and then took off. So
okay.
Yeah,
well, that's good. It's on father son fishing derby, yeah. Running naked with twigs in your hair. That sounds like a good bonding experience. That's awesome.
Yes, but I did that by myself.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah. While our guest host does not run naked with twigs in her hair, she's
that
still pretty darn awesome. Listeners will recognize the Guild of the Cowrie Catchers as one of the icons of podcast fiction. Also, of course, the Prophet of Panamandora. She's done extensive work in the world of Panamandora and has other works out there. Her work has appeared on the Doonstief, the Drabblecast, Cast of Wonders, Cast Macabre. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to the big comfy chair at the round table, Abigail Hilton. Abby, thank you so much for coming and helping us workshop a story today.
You're welcome, Dave.
You really don't run, just for our listeners and for my own, you don't run naked with twigs in your hair, do you?
Well, I can't say.
Okay, all right, say no more, wait, nudge. Right, okay. Abby, you have been writing since you were a teenager, vast epic volumes, tomes. Your work has appeared in so many places. You've done so much already. What's coming up next for you? What does our listenership need to know about what's next on Abigail Hilton's schedule?
Well, near the end of this month, the fourth illustrated volume of Cowrie Catchers will be coming out.
Very cool.
And you can also read Hunters Unlucky on my website, abigailhilton.net. It is a novel in progress that I deconstruct for you as I write it. It's a rewrite of a very old book, and I take it apart at the seams like a little teddy bear, and then sew it back together as a Cthulhu doll. So if you would like to read me deconstruct my own work, and also a story that I think you'll find entertaining, go to abigailhilton.net and then click on Hunters Unlucky and Novel in Progress. And there's about 85,000 words up there right now, and it'll be probably 150,000 words total. So there's plenty for you to read.
Excellent. Awesome. Are you going to be doing any more work for the Doonstief or any audio production, do you think, or voice
Absolutely.
Work?
Absolutely. I am working on the audio version for the fourth book of Cowrie Catchers. I know I've got a lot of really impatient fans out there. I took a long break between books 3 and 4 for a lot of reasons. I was traveling for work around the country, so it wasn't terribly convenient to record audio at that point. But I've got one more chapter to record, and then I will have all my narration recorded, which means I can work on it anywhere. And then I've got about half of the voice track done. So that if I had to make a guess, I would say August, but I can't make promises until I have the work of every single person who's contributing. So sometimes something happens and it takes them longer. So I can't make promises about the speed of other people's work. Sure. But if I had to make a guess, I would say August for the podcast. And yes, I do voice work for the Dune Steef. Dan Sawyer asked me to do voice work for one of his books the other day.
Very cool.
Every once in a while I turn up on the Drabblecast. So my voice is around. And of course you can hear me and Brian Lincoln on a Fullcast podcast.
Which the URL is?
I believe it's fullcastpodcast.com.
I think you're right.
If you search for it, you'll definitely find it under that.
That's right. And if nothing else, it's going to be in the liner notes, kids. So don't worry if there's a hyphen in there or not. We'll just give you a nice, convenient link. You just click and go and enjoy the awesomeness. I know you were at Balticon. Are you going to be doing any other cons this year?
I was. That was so much fun.
That was a blast.
Somebody made a Silvio doll. I took all kinds of pictures with it, with all kinds of people in various states of intoxication. It was fabulous.
Yes.
Really, seriously, if you like podcasting at all, come to Balticon because we're all there.
It's the event. It is definitely the event.
It's a pajama party with all your favorite podcasters. A drunken pajama party.
With awesome voices everywhere you turn.
It's true. I might go to Dragon Con. I haven't decided yet.
Okay. And you got WorldCon coming up, Chi-Con in Chicago.
That's true. See, I've never been to anything but BalticCon and Dragon Con and once OriCon. But I should consider other conventions. You're right.
I went to WorldCon many years ago and it was an awesome experience. If nothing else, the writers that you see there, the stellar luminaries walking around the hallways, it's amazing. Why don't we take a brief pause right now and we'll do a promotional break for an awesome podcast or other literary event. And when we come back, we'll workshop a vampire story. Sound good?
Sounds fabulous.
Sounds excellent.
I'm looking forward to it too. All right, friends, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I am Athel, seraph of the first choir. I was the first Aeonian across that barrier that separates mortality from eternity, and the individual from the indivisible. I was the first angel amongst men. Mankind was simpler then, and your squabbles were petty, but in them I saw the seeds of the war, so I came amongst you and taught the conflict. A lowlands tribe, eager to prepare for the coming of the great enemy, gathered in their neighbors, uniting them into a nation. But those who would not consent to be gathered were conquered. I had given you the war, but the enemy had not yet come. And so you reached out to find one. I shall carry this regret for all eternity. Before ever you knew what a demon was, an angel taught you to hate.
'Twixt Heaven and Hell by Tristan Gregory. Available now at Amazon and Smashwords.
And we're back. Welcome back, everybody. We're about to get into the really awesome section that we have a tendency to get a little bit carried away with. This is where we bring in a guest writer who's going to give us a story idea that we can pull apart and have some fun with. So, Dave, why don't you tell us who we got?
I would be delighted to, Brian. Our guest writer is actually, she grew up in a haunted house and apparently has had quite enough of ghosts for one lifetime. Wrote her first vampire novel in middle school and has been writing them ever since. Once had a job buying games for a living. How awesome is that? And though she lived right at the fringe of Milwaukee. She never went to Gen Con while it was at Milwaukee. It was only until it got to Indy because she was trying to get people to pay her way. And I respect that. Now, her work has appeared in 14 anthologies, including, and Brian, you need to get this for your wife, yes. Hungry for Your Love, an anthology of zombie romance.
Oh, my good Lord.
Get that bad boy for Allie. She will love it.
No shit.
Now, not only has she done this with all of this behind her, but she's also written and put out her first full novel, Scent and Shadow. No soulmates, no love triangles, no sparkles. This is serious vampire shit going on here, guys. You can find out more at www.scentandshadow.com. Paperback is available on CreateSpace, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the Book Depository. Ebook format, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, Smashwords, Kobo, Diesel, Sony, and OmniLit. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Skype line, our brave and fearless guest writer for this episode, Mercy Loomis. Mercy, thank you so much for stepping up and offering up a story for the roundtable. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Oh, it's going to be great fun. Great fun. So, Mercy, writing a vampire novel in middle school, really?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
Why not?
Well, yes, obviously, why not? But we're trying to get at the inner root, the core of her motivation here, yes. Brian. Shush.
Of course. Sorry.
Well, it's funny because, you know, these vampires and scary things, you know, of course, scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. And I don't know why all of a sudden they just got interesting. And that was a terrible novel, I'm sure. I honestly don't even know how long it was. It's all written in notebooks and longhand upstairs somewhere in a box.
Take a page from Abby's book and rip that bad boy out and start retooling it.
To give us some context, how old are you now? I'm 35, so you know how old I am.
Oh, I'm 35 as well.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. So that was a long time ago. In other words, middle school. Yeah. That was before vampires were cool. That was like Anne Rice vampires. There were no...
I was really into P.N. Elrod. She writes vampires set in the 1930s in Chicago, which was a really fabulous series. I was never that into Anne Rice, but I liked some of the more... I should say the less popular ones. But it just, you know, vampires that were bad.
Before they were cool,
it was bad, but, you know, other vampires that were bad.
Cool. And you've brought to the table yet another vampire story. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yes. Awesome. This is our first vampire story, right?
I know.
See, I told you, Mercy, Brian's bouncing in his seat going, yes. Very cool. Well, let's turn the mic over to you then. We'll give you 5 to 8 minutes. Honest, we won't gong you if you go over, but try not to. Keep that nice and tight. Give us title, genre, format, some key characters, and then some story arc. And from there, we'll start workshopping that bad boy.
All right. Well, the working title is Empire Shadow. I'm thinking it's going to be a short novel. The story is about some of the characters from Scent and Shadow. Scent and Shadow takes place in 1999. And I'm going to use the anglicized versions of the characters' names for the podcast just to make life easier. And Empire Shadow starts in 113 AD. Gabriel is a vampire who was turned in about 78 BC. He spent the years since then living in caves around Verona, Italy, and preying on a very wide territory. Vampires in my story verse kill a human a night for the first 10 years or so, and slowly taper down to a kill every few weeks with regular non-lethal feedings in between. And he discovered a few years ago that he has a half-breed son, but he hasn't contacted him. He's just kind of been watching from the shadows. Paul is a half-human, half-vampire. He's about 12 years old. He's never met his father and has had to figure out how to deal with and hide his differences, mostly by himself. He ages at the normal rate, and he only drinks animal blood at this point. And another character we'll get to later is Isolde. She's a skin shifter. She lives in Britain. She's a few years older than Paul, and she's a thief. And skin shifters are shape-changing fairies, but they're very limited in what shapes they can take. All the skin shifters are born with two skins, the one they're actually born in, which is usually human, and one other that they get from their mother.
And the way they get more skins is by, while in their ether form, invading a living creature and severing the tie that binds its soul to its body. And geek that I am, I actually made up D20 rules for this.
Sweet.
So the story opens in Italy with Paul having discovered girls. Unfortunately, his instincts are all messed up. He ends up biting the girl he's making out with, but he doesn't yet know how to change her memory or heal her. So there's a little bit of an uproar there. That night, Gabriel shows up and tells Paul's mother that she can't protect Paul anymore, but he can, and she reluctantly lets Gabriel take Paul away. Paul and Gabriel move to Britain, the idea being it's easier to reinvent yourself at the edge of the world than in the middle of it. Gabriel buys a small rural villa and enough slaves to run it, and they settle down near London. There's a certain amount of the usual awkward father-son stuff. Now, everything in ancient Rome has to be done in person, and when you're in business, there's a certain amount of elbow rubbing and socializing that just has to be done. So Gabriel ends up at dinner parties and evening entertainments, and he probably screws some of those up because he's not used to having to hide what he is or being around people so much, and he was never part of that kind of higher society to begin with. I'm thinking he gets on the wrong side of one of the local mages, probably because they both want to influence the same magistrate. One evening, when they're all out at one of these entertainments, Isolde tries to pick Gabriel's pocket. He catches her, but he realizes there's something kind of weird about her. The sentence for theft is debt bondage, and the mage steps up and says he would happily buy her debt bond from Gabriel. Isolde is suddenly terrified because she can escape from just about any confinement unless it's magical. Paul doesn't want to give her to the mage because she's so scared of him, and Gabriel wants to tweak the mage's nose, so he makes her his own debt slave. Isolde doesn't know what Gabriel and Paul are, and they don't know what she is, but they all know none of them smell human. Gabriel and Isolde strike a bargain. If she teaches Paul's thief skills, Gabriel will legally free her after a certain time, and this will make her a Roman citizen, which is her dearest wish. They'll have to find out about each other's natures eventually, but I'm still a little fuzzy on that part. The mage tries to assassinate Gabriel during the day while Paul is gone, but is interrupted by Isolde and Anna, one of Gabriel's guardians. During the fight, Isolde is more or less forced to steal the mage's skin to defeat him. She then has to pretend to be him so that he's seen leaving the villa. She goes back to his house and then shifts form and leaves. She's afraid that she'll run into another skin shifter while she's still wearing his skin, because skin shifters recognize each other with their ether sense, not with sight, and stealing human skins is forbidden. Gabriel frees Isolde early because she fought for him. He wants to adopt her, but females can only be adopted through an imperial decree. Isolde continues living and working at the villa as Gabriel's freedwoman. For Paul's coming of age, Gabriel buys him a concubine. When Paul and the slave have sex, Paul loses control and consumes her, triggering his transition into full adulthood. Since he's never had sex before and never killed anyone before, you can imagine how much this messes with him. Paul and Gabriel have a fight, and Paul decides he needs some space, so he joins the army. If he has to kill people, at least they don't have to be helpless. And he's accepted as a recruit into the 9th Legion in Northern Britain. The skin shifters among the Ordovices from Wales have wanted to drive out the Romans since Agricola kicked their asses in the 70s, but they haven't found the right opportunity. A year or so after Paul joins the 9th, they team up with a Scottish warlord and plan to attack at night from the north. Isolde finds out about this and warns Paul just before the attack starts. Since Paul knows something about shifters, he's able to rally a cohort or so, and even though the Legion is mostly wiped out, they're able to kill the warlord and do enough damage that the Northerners can't continue their push south. As the surviving shifters flee into Faerie, one of the shifters recognizes Isolde and vows vengeance on her and the villa. Isolde and Paul also try to cut through Faerie, but Faerie doesn't want to let Paul through, so the shifters get a head start. The villa is completely unprepared for a horde of angry shifters. Gabriel and his guardians hear the commotion in time to grab weapons, but many members of the household are killed and buildings are set on fire. Gabriel and the guardians are trapped by the fire, and two of the guardians are killed, holding off the shifters while Paul and Isolde fight their way in and pull Gabriel and Anna to safety. The remaining shifters die in the fire or are killed. Isolde is grievously wounded in the fight, and Gabriel turns her, but it's incredibly difficult because she's a shifter, and this involves huge emotional and personal cost on Gabriel's part and monumental pain on Isolde's part. And the story closes with Gabriel, Paul, and Isolde using mind tricks to get a private audience with the Emperor Hadrian so he will formalize Isolde's adoption by Gabriel. Themes include loyalty, family, and no good deed goes unpunished. Any and all comments and questions, welcome, but I have three issues in particular I'm looking for help with. One is I have a bunch of things that happened, but I don't have a story.
And okay.
I find the frame and the through line. I'm thinking it's going to be Paul's frame, but I'm not entirely sure. Two, my antagonists are very fuzzy. Three, I need to get Paul from York to London for the final showdown, but in my story verse, Fairy shouldn't let Paul in. So I need to figure out how to get around that. And Brian, go as dark as you want. The ending is
sweet.
Oh, God, what have you done? Awesome. Very cool. Well, before we get into, well done, Mercy. Nicely done. Good story pitch. Lots of good food to chew on in there. First, we need to give our standard disclaimer. Brian, would you be so kind?
Sure, sure. Through the course of discourse, I suppose.
Is that from Jersey? During discourse, you're going to... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. We'll be throwing a lot of things your direction, ideas, and many of them brilliant, but just like anybody else, most of our ideas could and very likely are complete and total bullshit. So feel free to completely disregard anything that anybody says, including the guest host, even though most of the time, and definitely in this case, the guest host will be throwing very, very good things at you.
Pretty awesome stuff.
Yeah.
So. Awesome. Very cool. We always defer the table to our guest host for opening questions, observations, and to kick us off. So Abby, what was your first impression of Mercy's story idea? Any questions or clarifications that you want?
I love your world. Thank you. It's very cool. You said you've got at least one other book that happens in this world, correct?
Yes. I actually have a whole series of shorts and novellas. The world set is called Aether Vitalis. And so there's Scent and Shadow, which is the story that this is a prequel to. Mm-hmm. There is a novella called Demon's Asylum, which takes place in London in 1794. And that's another vampire story. And then there's a novella that is free most places called A Wild Hunt, which... also takes place in Madison, and Scent and Shadow takes place in Madison. Wild Hunt takes place about 10 years after Scent and Shadow, and that's mostly about skin shifters. And then there's a few other stories floating around that are about various shifters, mages, a few vampires show up, that kind of thing.
Cool. Yeah, no, I really like. I was asking because you said that you were a little bit boxed in because of the world, and I was trying to figure out how much of the world is established. So you are, I understand. Look, so this is a prequel, and it's in an established world. So I've done things like that before. So you're boxed in to a certain extent as far as the rules that you've created, and also it's got to jive with other storylines. Got it. Okay.
Yep.
So how much of this is written already?
Almost none of it. Okay. There's almost 15,000 words of backstory that I did on this in 2008, and most of it's actually stuff that's not going to be in this story. I was feeling out kind of how Gabriel, because Gabriel did not have a mentor. His sire was killed immediately. And there's actually going to be a novella for that should be coming out. I'm not sure when this airs, so it either will be out shortly or is already out, called Knight's Acolyte, and that deals with Gabriel's becoming a vampire. But so he's had to figure all of this stuff out on his own.
I had another question that occurred to me while you're talking is the characters, are any of them already kind of their personalities set from appearance in a different book, or are they haven't really been explored yet?
The difference is they've all been explored in Scent and Shadow, but that takes place almost 1,900 years later. So they're, and this is where they're all pretty young. You know, Isolde's not a vampire yet. Gabriel is not a sociopath yet.
Paul, this is an origin story.
So Gabriel, Paul, and Isolde all appear in Scent and Shadow?
Yep.
They're all much later. Okay.
Much later.
That's an origin story. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so one thing that I noticed when I listen to these a lot, people tend to, they describe the plot, and they don't necessarily describe the character. So these three characters are obviously the focal point of the story. Describe their personalities. I mean, are they idealists, or are they pragmatists? Are they driven by gut emotions, or are they, you know, deep, intricate thinkers, tacticians, strategists? Like, what, to give us, paint us a picture of, like, of the characters themselves, who are they?
Gabriel is a cleric of night, but that doesn't, it doesn't factor in a lot of ways, but it's, it kind of underlies his entire existence.
What does that mean?
Basically, if she ever told him to do something, he would do it. Knight. Knight. The goddess Knight.
See, yeah. I heard night as in not day. I didn't
hear he has a goddess of some kind who's his puppeteer.
Right. She basically lets them on a pretty loose leash most of the time, but it's just one of those things that kind of is always in the back of his head. But he is...
So is that his moral compass? Is that like his... Yeah, his ethical system is simply this person?
To a point. Anything that has to deal with, you know, either being a vampire or killing people or basically keeping the vampires around and breeding and all that stuff, that is formed by his relationship with Nox. But his own moral compass, as far as, you know, he keeps his word if he gives it to somebody who actually means anything to him. Okay. He definitely feels loyalty, responsibility, duty. As soon as he finds out that he has a son, he's making sure that, you know, this kid's going to be okay. When he sees that this is not going to happen, even though he, you know, is obviously not a normal father figure at this point, he's going to step in because that's his duty. He has a duty to this person, even though he's never actually met him.
Okay. So he's got a moral... So does he see humans as a different species that he doesn't have the same ethical obligations to, or is he pretty much like he deals with everyone in a way that he thinks is honest and that he also feels some moral obligation towards human beings? I mean, when you're dealing with a monster, it's part of humanizing the monster is that they have some ethical system. It's just not our ethical system.
Right. In general, he doesn't really feel that obligated to humans. There's the occasional individual human who, you know, either does something for him or somehow becomes his. It's kind of hard to, it's a little hard for me to explain just because I'm really used to the older Gabriel. And so I'm still kind of exploring younger, somewhat humanistic Gabriel here.
Well, that's something we can explore during the we can explore that during the discussion too.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's definitely interesting for me because I've worked with Gabriel so much when he's older and he knows what he's doing and he's incredibly confident and he has almost 2,000 years of experience of going. And here he's not even quite 200. He's never turned anyone. He's still figuring out a lot of what he can do and what he can't do. He's not in Scent and Shadow, he has a lot of psychic abilities. At this point in his life, he's really not that psychically talented. He didn't have a great aptitude for it as a human, so he had to develop it over many, many, many years of eating people.
So what about the personalities of the other two? Like, how are they different?
Isolde, at this point, she is a little bit wary. She's kind of been on her own for a while. She doesn't have a lot of connections with Shifter Society, even though they're a very it's not like a pack kind of thing, but they have a kind of a clannish thing they have going on where they're very insular among themselves. But Isolde's mother was one of the Ordovices. She saw the Romans come and stomp their asses and had said, you know, these are obviously the people that we need to be, you know, allying with because these Romans, they've got it going. And so she was very much pro-Roman. All of the other Ordovices, very not pro-Roman. So Isolde's kind of been brought up with this idealized portrait of what it means to be a Roman citizen. So she really wants this. This is something that's very important to her, even now after her mother is dead. It's something that kind of divides her from the rest of her species.
What does that represent to her?
to her, it kind of represents security, I think. Because, you know,
that's cool.
When the Romans came in, they really upset everything, especially in Wales. There's three legions in Britain, which is a stupid number of soldiers for such a small island. I mean, you have, like, Spain, I think, had one legion.
Yeah.
So Britain has three. Two of them are on the border of Wales. That's how much they had to pacify that country.
So Isolde is basically aligning herself with the power structure.
Right.
Okay.
So if she is concerned about security, I'm thinking this is a fairly concrete thinker, probably pretty pragmatic.
Yeah.
And probably protective of people that she cares about.
Very much
because
so.
She is concerned with security. Okay. Okay. I have a picture of her.
Okay. And Paul?
No.
Paul is, he's a young, adolescent boy. He's figuring out everything. He's really not sure who he is. He's grown up this entire time living among humans. He had no idea who or what he was. His mother really couldn't tell him anything. And so now he's with this, he's met his father. He's seeing all this stuff that his father does that he doesn't do. Because Paul is something, even though he's kind of found, this other half of himself, it's still not him. So he's still trying to figure out who he is. He's got that whole identity crisis thing going on. But in general, he's incredibly loyal. He's smart.
The identity crisis thing, is that just because of his age, or is he one of these people that is continually seeking self-actualization and trying to, learn more about who they are and will probably keep doing that their whole life? Or is that just because he's 12?
Part of it's because he's 12, and as he moves out through, I think he gets up to 16 or 17 in the storyline. But as he's moving through his teens, a lot of it's just because of that. But it's also, he kind of reinvents himself throughout the years as needed. He goes through a lot of different roles. Sometimes, there's times where he's a mercenary. There's times where he's a husband, there's times where he's a farmer. I mean, he goes through all of these different identities throughout the coming centuries.
So experience is important to him. Like, he wants to have a lot of different experiences. That's important to him.
Yeah, and he basically tries not to let
okay, so that's going to clash with a soul's desire to be safe. Okay, that's a tension. That's a point of tension. Okay.
Brian, what do you got for your first impressions?
Oh, my Lord.
I'm sorry. I went on and on.
No, not at all.
No, actually, everything that you asked for clarification, I think it brought me to a point where I, it was such a concise pitch that I couldn't write fast enough. and so I just spent the last 10 minutes catching up. I think this is Paul's story, I think. Is that, would you agree?
I think so. I think the kind of the way it's falling into place is it's Paul's story. It's figuring out what the through line is. That's going to be the hard part.
Right. And it seems like a kind of a coming of age, where I see a lot of struggle within Paul, especially, you have him doing all of these different things and like Abigail said, experience is important to him, but it seems like that means that human experience is important to him. And so he's struggling to hold on to any humanity that he might have left at any given time, which is going to put him immediately at odds with his father. Especially if he's got this incredible psychic ability and his father hasn't even developed that yet.
Yeah.
Gabriel sounds to me like a strategist, and Paul sounds like a tactician. Just going to sometimes put them at odds because his father sees the huge, grand, far-reaching picture, and he's going to be like a think on his feet sort of guy. It's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
this is awesome. You guys are giving me insight into my own characters that I don't actually have.
For me, I think there's so much to be explored with that, with Paul and with Gabriel. Gabriel not necessarily wanting to take on a mentee. And as you said, Gabriel didn't even have a mentor. And so it's kind of like the young father who has a son and then doesn't know what to do with him because his own father was absent. And so he's Gabriel's struggling and Paul is struggling with his own things. And Gabriel's trying to be this mentor, but he's mentoring him in things that Paul doesn't understand and that Paul mm-hmm. almost is fighting against. And, you know, I don't know that you'd want to go so far as like, you know, Paul is completely rebelling, but, you know, maybe very ethically conflicted about his gifts and about what he's becoming and what he has to do. Not necessarily, you know, a la Interview with the Vampire, where it's this massive struggle between, you know, Lestat and Louis, but, mm-hmm. Going in a different direction with it. And I think, it, you know, it could be really, really fascinating and just exciting to see how Paul comes to terms with all of these things. And then you throw Isolde into the mix and everything just gets all fucked up. I think there's a shitload of really fascinating stuff in here.
Oh, yeah.
I just don't know where to start.
Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You've got Scent and Shadow, which takes place 900 plus years in the future. Why go back and write a prequel? What motivated you to see what gap or what elements of the original story sparked your imagination to go back and write this prequel?
Some of this is I get world builder's disease really badly. So this was stuff that I kind of have had in my head for several years anyway. And of the people who have read Scent and Shadow and talked to me about it, almost all of them want to know more about Gabriel. They want to know more about Paul. They want to know more about Isolde. Because they're not the main characters in that story. Okay. Well, Gabriel is one of the main characters, but it's actually him and then a human girl.
Is there anything in Scent and Shadow that you want explained in this book?
There's a lot of history that's alluded to and sort of mentioned in Scent and Shadow, particularly between Paul and Isolde. Both their beginning and they have a falling out at the Battle of Constantinople, which okay. is going to be a different story.
Next book.
Yeah, I think that one will be on the novella, but it's going to be fun. And it's just, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens, and it's really interesting. And I think people would enjoy the stories. It's just I have to find the right frame for it.
Okay. Well, then everything that we give you, you're going to need to filter and probably shape in that direction. Because we haven't read Scent and Shadow, and I'm sorry to say that because now I want to, because it sounds awesome. But so as we start throwing out motivations and ideas and so on, just keep mm-hmm. in mind that you're slotting this into the continuum of what you've already defined.
Right.
So now,
and I'll say I did read the first chapter of it. That unfortunately that was all that I had time to read, but I'm sucked in. And so I'll definitely read the rest of it. But in that first chapter, already there is tension between Gabriel and Paul, mm-hmm. like massive. And I don't know how intentional that was yet because I haven't read the rest of it, but it's one of those things that you know that they're related, but they don't like being at the same table, even though they sort of have to be. And that's all that I've been able to glean from just that one little snippet.
Okay.
So when you started talking about this, that was my immediate, you know, direction that I was heading was mm-hmm. what happened back in because it was deep seated tension. It wasn't just, you know, God damn it, you won last time we played Settlers of Catan. Because you know,
vampires are into board games. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is years and years. And apparently this is years and years and years and years and years.
So with that in mind, then if Brian, as you say, the first chapter already defines that tension, then Mercy, a cool thing to do at the onset would be to have Paul and Gabriel get along famously.
Well, the tension that's in the beginning of Scent and Shadow is not their normal tension. For lack of a better way of explaining it very quickly, Gabriel's being hormonal because the vampires have a reproductive cycle. And he's just basically hit his, his biological clock is ticking. So he's definitely testy at that point. Okay. But
does that tension sustain throughout?
Every 200 years or so?
Yep, about every 200.
Oh, God.
and So at and okay. that's it, it. That actually factors into Empire of Shadow as well, because Gabriel's getting up to his first 200 years. He's almost 200 years old, and that actually does factor into something toward the end.
Then that's not necessarily germane to what we're talking about here then. Okay. Yeah. That's cool. Well, let me just throw out a couple of things, and then I want to get back to Abigail's perspective on all of this. Some things that jumped out at me. In terms of finding a framework, in terms of finding pivotal crisis points around which to build a framework. First of all, something that was completely glossed over, and I think maybe you might want to explore more, is the fact that Gabriel apparently loved this woman who is Paul's mother enough to sire a child with her. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that wasn't how you were looking at, but an interesting thing would be, how does a vampire love a human woman?
That is going to be a subplot in this.
Okay, all right, good.
With Paul's mother, but with a different person.
Okay, but Paul's mother, so is she just being pushed aside then? Is she, yes, I birthed this boy, oh, my son, and we never hear from her anymore?
So far, yes. I wouldn't mind having her be in here, but she's still in Italy and he's in Britain.
Well,
so
no, that's fine. That
having, like, strange letters could be kind of fun, but
well, and I'm thinking just in terms of the emotional background from Gabriel's standpoint, and an informative aspect for Gabriel is, you know, his past with Paul's mother. Okay.
Well, also, does Paul have a bunch of human siblings? Is this a case of, like, this is the black sheep that everyone is just relieved is finally gone because he was so weird and he killed the neighbor's dogs? And, oh, my God. Like, he just, like, is it that sort of thing? Like, I wish I'd never had this kid and I've got 12 others, so it doesn't matter? Or, like,
no, Paul's mother loves him very much. She's protected him his entire life. Just to kind of give you an idea how much she actually wanted this child, you know, half-breeds are born with teeth. and you know, they suckle milk or blood along with their milk. I mean, it's kind of, you kind of really have to love that kid.
Ouch.
You know, she's been going out of her way to try and protect him, throughout his life. And this is, it's just gotten to the point where she doesn't have a way of keeping him in line anymore. But she does have, she did remarry, or I should say marry for the first time, with this other guy. They had some kids together. Paul's close with one of his siblings, but the rest of them not so much. He's not close with his stepfather. His stepfather actually threatens to sell him at one point.
Okay. Did his mom know that what Gabriel was?
Well, it's interesting because actually at this point, Gabriel doesn't even know what Gabriel is. He's a demon of some sort. But
did she know he was different?
Yes.
He was touched in some way.
When they met, she was about to be raped on the road by two brigands, and he ate them. in the course of a very odd conversation, which was a lot of fun to write, which has got to show up somewhere someday. it was just going to be a little one night stand. He sets her up somewhere because, you know, him and Lucretia was kind of how Gabriel started coming back into interacting with humans.
There, right there. That's the point I'm getting at, right there.
Mm-hmm.
That is the importance and the relevance of Paul's mother in this story. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to signpost that and say that's, you know, because of that transition, that shift in Gabriel's character, she's relevant and perhaps deserves more attention. The other thing worthy of greater attention, I think, might be the mage and the magistrate, and that's the nature of that conflict. That seems, if nothing else, the mages feel strongly enough to try and assassinate Gabriel later. So whatever's going on there, that conflict, that seems to be deep-seated, at least from the mage's standpoint, which makes it an important crisis point to pay attention to.
Yeah, I need help with that part.
Okay. Nacht. The cleric of Nacht and the aspect of this goddess of vampires, basically, that's something that is looming in the background as a potential anchor point for a framing story element. And the end result of Isolde being turned, a skinwalker being turned into a vampire, that sounds momentous. That sounds like something a prophecy could be wrapped around. Or some deep travesty that should never happen for various reasons or whatever, something along those lines.
Kind of underworldish.
Yeah.
It's pretty awful, really.
Yeah. So those are the key elements, just in terms of a grand story arc. Just the other scene that really just jumped out at me more than anything was Paul's killing of the concubine when he comes of age, yes. And the Gabriel's fight after that. That's that of all the scenes that you described, that one just blazed like the sun to me. So that's something that might be worth looking at as well. Abby, what else you got?
Where does the story begin?
I've toyed with a lot of different beginnings. I've toyed with a lot of different beginnings. Originally, I was actually going to start the story with Gabriel being turned, and then I realized that having 100+ years jump in the middle of it would be kind of dumb. So I split his bit off, and then I was going to start it actually with Gabriel and Lucretia, but there's, again, another 10-year gap in between Gabriel and Lucretia's, you know, and Paul's conception, and when Gabriel actually finds out that he had a son. Because he liked Lucretia enough to not keep in touch, because he's a very bad, dangerous thing, was kind of the way he looked at it. He did not want anything bad to happen to her, so he was going to leave her alone.
He took the high road.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's kind of how he is with humans that, for whatever reason, he gets any sort of attachment to, is he will very much take the high road with them, but only with them.
So, Abby, what do you think in terms of where the story could start?
Well, you were asking, you were talking about what you ultimately wanted it to be about, and where you choose to start it is a big part of that. And
good point. Right,
you know, obviously, it's recommended that you start in medias res, which means somewhere in the middle of the actual story. And that doesn't mean it has to be full of flashbacks, but you often have opportunities to work in, you know, relevant information, like as you proceed through a story. And it's much more interesting to have like back mysteries in the background than to have everything in the foreground. You start before anything has actually happened. So, I mean, I don't know. It just, where you choose to start it.
What about POVs? How many POVs are you looking at?
I'm guessing it's going to be at least those three, Paul and Gabriel and Isolde, because there's going to be some stuff that's just going to have to be told from their different points of view, especially once Paul goes north.
Okay.
But I don't think I would need any other points of view, but
I don't think so either.
You know, I ended up with an awful lot more of them in Scent and Shadow than I originally intended. So, but that was a much more complex storyline than I think this is going
to
be.
So let me just put this out to the group. Brian put out that this is Paul's story. Abby, what do you think?
I think that's up to Mercy.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, of course, all of it's up to Mercy. Absolutely. But given the framework that Mercy has laid out, and given your unique perspective on storytelling and writing, give Mercy the benefit of from your perspective, where the strengths of the storyline seem to be.
I think it's sort of like when you wrote the novel that comes after, or the epic that comes after Cowrie Catchers, and then you wanted to go back and fill in those antagonists, like you said. How did you figure out where to start?
Well, So my protagonist, he is a young person, and he falls in love with a court minstrel, and he ends up having a child with her, and that would have been fine, except that he chooses to marry her, and this makes his father very upset. He consults the local god, who is a wyvern. The god says, don't marry her. He went ahead and did it anyway, so he did it in the face of the god and his father, and then the wyvern asked for their child in sacrifice, and this happened in a way that he could not protect the infant. So their child was fed to the local deity, and he flees with Thessalan, the court minstrel, and the only place he can think of that he's sure he will be safe from the gods is the high priestess. So he goes into the temple service, but under the high priestess, which kind of puts them out of reach of the petty local deity of this small island where he comes from. You start the story at the point where he has been promoted to captain of the temple police, because her Morcella's service is mostly filled with thugs who come from kind of lower
class backgrounds. It's kind of unusual for an exiled prince to join her service, and he's more competent than a lot of the others. So you start the story at the point where he's been promoted, and some of his fellow officers feel very jealous and intimidated by him. But like all of that I just told you is backstory. Like at the point when he gets promoted, because it really is about his antagonistic relationship with his fellow officer in the Temple Sea Watch. So that's the point when they really start to clash, is when he gets promoted. So it depends on what you want the story to be about, like to me where you start it. And that's why I asked.
And I was kind of thinking that I would start it where Paul has just basically come to the point where he needs to leave the humans. You know, he needs to you know, where Gabriel comes and says, this is going to be a problem, let me take him.
So if you want it to be about his relationship with his father, I would start it at the point where they meet. Mm-hmm. When they first lay eyes on each other and get some feelings about each other, and like, and then as interesting backstory, you have Paul's struggle with what he is, and like he's bringing all of those pent up emotions and experiences to the table with this person who has all the answers, or he thinks has all the answers, and who in fact has never dealt with a child and doesn't have all the answers, but
or at least not this kind of a child. He did have children when he was human.
Yeah. So I mean, if you want it to be about, and if you do that, then the finale has to be either something like Paul realizing that his father is actually a person and not a figure with all the answers, or you know, then the finale and the conclusion have to somehow speak to that. If you want it to be about his relationship with Isolde, then you know, you could potentially start it much further forward in time.
That's an interesting idea too, of starting it basically with Isolde and then throwing her in as the character who has no idea what's going on.
If you make it really about him, then if I were you, which, I mean, it's your story, but I would sink it deeply in his POV. Because I've noticed that, I mean, there's a desire to jump around between points of view because it gives you lots of different eyeballs in the story, and you can see lots of different things. The problem is it's a little bit jarring every time you jump. You know, every time you jump, the reader has to pull themselves back out of that character and insert themselves into a new character. And, I mean, if you keep it in one person's point of view, you sink them deeply, deeply, deeply into the story and keep them there. So, I mean, if it's really about him, I would stay close to his point of view. But if it's about their three relationship, then that's different. And you know, you can show us what Paul is like from inside his own head, and then you can show us how he is perceived by Isolde, which might be completely different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, when you can see someone's thoughts. I mean, Gerard in my story is a very intimidating character, and I tell the first chapter is from Morcella's point of view. It's the only place where I cheat and kind of give somebody else's look at him, but he's both attractive, physically attractive, but also very intimidating, and people react to him in a way that is kind of contrary to his internal monologue, because his internal monologue is pretty gentle, but he's also very quiet, and people don't realize, you can't tell he's a large looming person who's good with a sword. So I mean you can do that. I mean, you can show what Gabriel appears to be to these two characters versus what he's like from inside his own head, and you can, you know, create tension with the disparity between these three different points of view and kind of split them up equally.
Well, and Abby, you raise a good point. You know, the ability to see from multiple POVs casts the primary character, whoever that is. In this case, I think we're looking at Paul, as gives those multiple perspectives, which fleshes him out that much more. Plus, you have such a rich world, with such a rich mythology, that, you know, the skin shifters have their own culture. The vampires, clearly, I mean, they've got a god, so there's a culture there, and apparently a breeding cycle as well. Plus, we haven't even talked about mages, and apparently they're out there too.
Yep.
So I think,
not to mention a whole bunch of other kinds of fairies, but they don't really come into the story, so we'll leave them alone.
Isolde will be our gate. Isolde will be our gate to the Fey world. Gabriel will be our gate to the vampire world. And Paul is going to be kind of the reader's POV, because Paul really, you know, starting him as young as he is half human. He's half human, exactly. He's very young. He knows nothing about this. So all of the questions that the reader is going to have, Paul is going to have as well. So you can get around a lot of the heavy-handed, as you know, Bob stuff.
Right.
By having Paul very naturally being curious or making mistakes and making bad choices, and having giving Gabriel the opportunity to educate him.
The trap with Paul will be preventing him from becoming the bland vehicle character, you know, by which you explore the world and the other characters. I mean, you won't have to have a personality, I think. It's easy to have that sort of middle vehicle exploratory character become a character with no real interesting personality in and of himself.
Sure.
Mercy, can I ask you real quick, what is your intended audience for this?
Adults. Age-wise? Adults, okay. It's an adult story.
Okay.
Any story where I kill someone while they're having sex.
Yeah, good call.
I was going to say.
Good call.
Right. Yeah. Nah, 8-year-olds. Family car vacation book.
Because I'm looking at Paul's age, and your typical readership wanting to be able to associate with the main character, and if he's too much younger than them. I mean, I don't know if it will be that much of a problem. That's not a hard, fast rule. It's just one of those things that I see.
It's a good point.
Frequently. You know, YA novels have a tendency to have a main character that's within the age range of the, or slightly above the age of the audience that they're looking to.
It can be an uphill battle to convince people that a 12-year-old protagonist is in a book for adults.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I could shorten up the timeline a little bit by, you know, but he couldn't be much older than 14 when it starts, because the coming of age for a Roman is 15 or 16.
I mean, if you really want to jar people and make them sit up straight, start with a scene where he kills the concubine. Throw him, kick him right there into it. Make him hate him right off the bat, and then build sympathy for him for the rest of the story. That'll mess up people's heads.
I don't know if you could really hate him for that, though. He hates himself for it.
But you would if you didn't know him. You certainly would.
Well, and what I had written down when you guys were talking about a starting point, and you know, the point where Paul and Gabriel meet. If Gabriel, I would think from what you've told us about Gabriel that he would have taken an interest in his son. Mm-hmm. And if they haven't met yet, then Gabriel is probably watching him from time to time.
Yes.
And if he then, because of all of these things that are changing in him, engages in some horrific scene that happens to him, or he, you know, unknowingly puts himself in that position, and Gabriel has to step in, that kind of a meeting would be, I think, a kind of a really interesting place to start.
You could just have him interrupt him, you know, I mean? with the girl. That could be interesting.
Right. Mercy, what's the problem with Paul being a Roman citizen and picking him up when he's 17?
It's not so much that the idea was he's, you know, the biology for the half-breeds is that they age pretty much normally, and they can't kill people by drinking them to death, or at least they can't consume the life until they hit puberty. And at that point, some gears start to switch, hormones turn on, other things turn off. And the first person that they have sex with, they're going to kill, they're going to consume their life. It's going to basically flip those switches to the point where he is going to stop aging normally. He'll start aging at a very slow rate, but he's going to have to start killing people.
Okay. So Gabriel knows when he gives him this concubine what's going to happen. No.
Gabriel suspects, he's kind of got a bad feeling, but
he does it anyway.
But Paul doesn't. That's definitely a
Paul has no
idea. Hold against him.
Yeah. This whole thing is a huge rift between Paul and Gabriel. because Paul pretty much blames his father for all of this, and Gabriel's like, look, I had a feeling this was going to happen eventually. I just needed to make sure it was in a controlled circumstance.
So the primary problem with picking up Paul later on is that he's already gone through puberty, and technically, by the biology and the rules of your world, he should have already come into his maturity as a vampire?
Yeah, because it's like, no offense, guys, what Hornball's teenage boys are.
No offense at all. And for the record, the older guys are kind of Hornballs too, but go ahead.
Right, but they don't have control yet. And it's actually worse with the half-breeds, because they're kind of used to the bloodlust. They've had it most, their entire lives. They've never had a problem with it. He spent his entire life, drinking from things, occasionally people, but mostly animals, and he's never had that overwhelming need to kill them like the vampires do.
So is this definitely a coming of age story? Like, is that definitely what it is about?
I'm thinking it's a kind of a story about family and figuring out where you are in a family, because
and in the world,
Paul, it's partly a coming of age thing, but for him it's a coming of age where he is figuring, he's figuring out who he is, but he's also figuring out his relationship with his father and his adopted sister.
So let me throw a 180 out. Here's a what if, just to see if it sparks anything. Mm-hmm. Paul's mother mm-hmm. beds a demon after mm-hmm. nearly being raped by highwaymen.
Mm-hmm.
Witnesses them literally ravaged. And in her weakened state, gloms on to the Ravager as her savior, mm-hmm. Which is kind of Helsinki syndrome,
right,
dysfunctional, right. Weird. They have a week of impassioned romance where the mother, still psychologically afflicted by the trauma that she's endured, literally loses her mind for a while and falls into the shadow that Gabriel represents.
Or she's just glad to be alive, and this is how she expresses
it. Roll with me on this one. Roll with me on this one just a little bit, okay? Eventually, Gabriel's better nature takes over, and he realizes that he's corrupting this poor woman, literally luring her over to the dark side. Maybe he wants to turn her, but he doesn't know how. And maybe he loves her. Maybe in these 2 weeks that he's discovered almost what could be a soulmate, but his ignorance denies him the ability to turn her, and the torment in his own heart and seeing her responding so passionately to his darkness, his nobility awakens, and he literally leaves her. He says, I can't do this. I cannot do this. Which throws her into a tailspin. She turns to religion. She turns to the faith, whatever the faith is in your world, and becomes this righteous creature. When she finds that a demon spawn is growing in her womb, she's torn between literally tearing it out and dashing it against the rocks, or maybe wanting to somehow take that shadow that he implanted in her and turn it into light. And so Paul's whole childhood has been immersed, submerged, forced into this religious, righteous fury, this fervor and he's literally, he's been warped by this. And then these urges come on. And Gabriel, of course, is always in the background somewhere. And he gets with this 12-year-old girl. And never mind that he bites her. Have him just savage her. Because pent-up religious frustration and so on, combined with puberty and sexual impulses, have him destroy her, literally, and have that be witnessed somehow. He's hosed. He's in an untenable situation. Mother might even cast him out. And then Gabriel comes. He's chased, hounded by the villagers who see him as a demon, blah, blah, blah. And then there's Gabriel. And so and I'm rambling. But
no, you're also playing with the name, because Gabriel's usually the angel that saves everyone.
Yes, exactly.
And then his savior out of this religious context is this vampire with
the name Gabriel. Yes, exactly.
That has lots of I see that as a great short story. I don't see the story starting here, but that sounds like a fantastic side story.
No, yeah, I don't see it starting. I can see it starting with Paul maybe walking down the lane with this 12-year-old, with this girl alone. Maybe bump it up to 13 or 14. But
he would need to be older.
Yeah. and you know, have it start with that, and then we can, you know, do a little bit of, you know, I have to go to prayers later, blah blah blah, but her blouse is low, and he can see her throat, and yada yada, and you know, I would see it starting at that.
So before he started even later than that. Just slightly, where he's just done it, and he's running through the alleyways, and he's dripping with blood, and every time that he runs into a wall, it gives him a little flash of what just happened.
Sure. And then he runs home and begs his mother, and his mother, you know, spurns him, casts him out. Ha ha.
Tries
pulling
to sleep,
entrails
dreams
from his teeth,
about it,
you know.
Over and over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. So the question: how much like the real world is this world? Is there a form of Christianity? Is there?
It's exactly like the real world. It's basically if you took all of the myths and legends and all of the stories that people have been telling forever, they're actually real. But all of history has happened the exact same way.
Okay.
Actually like down to like biology and physics, because I'm a geek. So it's just, you know, all of this stuff has been happening in the shadows, and most people don't realize it, but it's if you imagine everything in our real world is exactly the same.
So that was my other question. How many people are aware? Is it like completely, people are completely in the dark? It doesn't sound like people can be completely in the dark because there's magicians running around. So, I mean, is it a known thing? Vampires exist. You just don't know who they are. Or is it like, oh, no, that's not real. Or, you know, like magic exists, but only with the magicians. Like, how does that work?
Well, and particularly since we're dealing with, you know, very early ancient Rome, or that didn't make any sense, you know, second century Rome, at that point, everyone does believe in magic.
Okay.
Everyone does
okay.
believe in demons. Those beliefs have faded out over long periods since then. But at that point, yeah, everyone does okay. believe that these things exist.
Okay.
They just...
Okay.
You know, most people have never met one, and there's plenty, you know, a lot of people who just sort of laugh it off, and, you know, they may not laugh at the gods, but they'll laugh off other things, you know.
Okay, that makes sense. You said that your antagonists weren't well fleshed out. I'm seeing, so far this story looks like a series of skirmishes. There's got to be a big battle at some point. I mean, obviously we're not talking about real battles, but, like, you've got these series of events... And then they all feed into what?
They all basically culminate in this attack on their villa, you know, their safe place, their little haven.
Uh-huh.
And basically, and I didn't go into a lot of detail in the short version. Each of the three of them, through between the battle up at the north with the Ninth Legion and the battle for the villa. Each of them loses something that's incredibly precious to them and completely irreplaceable and completely changes their lives. You know, because it's... it's hard to go into... One of the things that happens when Isolde turns is that she is cut off from Fairy. Fairy does not let in things that eat energy, which is what vampires do. Because Fairy doesn't have it doesn't have a Higgs field, so everything's held together with energy.
Geek.
Yes, I am.
That's awesome.
Gabriel at that point had actually, I was thinking that he was going to have a love interest with one of his guardians, Anna, who
had
been grooming to be his first vampire. He was basically grooming her to become, you know, that. His first child, and she has to be killed as part of saving Isolde. And part of him saving Isolde burns out the last shreds of empathy that he had left. And basically he more or less becomes the sociopath that he is for the rest of the series.
Where did these guardians come from? You mentioned those at the end of your tale. You know, Gabriel and his guardians are attacked by the skin shifters. And where did they come from? Because that's the first time we'd heard of those.
They're like Renfields plus.
Okay.
Yeah, they're humans that he
So he acquires them after he gets to Britain.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he probably brought at least, I think he probably brought one with him, but,
so they're thralls of some kind.
Okay.
Yeah. They're like thralls, but they still have free will.
Okay. So So, I mean, it sounds to me, I mean, you were kind of being humble when you said that you have this series of events that aren't a story, because I would say this is a story.
Like, absolutely.
If you figure out where to start, I think that'll...
that's my problem. It's like, I used to be a total pantser. When I wrote Scent and Shadow, I just started and had no idea where I was going. And I could do that, and it takes forever, because you write until you realize that everything that you just did, you don't need. And then you have to figure out where to start over again. Oh, so I'm trying to kind of cut that down into finding where to start right the first time.
Well, and it seems, you know... As much as I agree that Paul is definitely kind of this focal point of this, Gabriel almost, because Gabriel has a separate story and he's also in Scent and Shadow, he seems like the through line. He seems like the Lestat character almost in that respect. So, I mean, while definitely I think Paul's story is fascinating, and I think introducing Isolde as ally, friend, love interest... is intriguing along those lines, but Gabriel really is kind of the spine. As long as Gabriel's in that opening bit somewhere, I think you'll be fine.
Okay. Yeah, you could spin this as this is how these two characters changed him.
Yeah.
You know, you could show it that way as in, you know, this is how he was changed as a result of relationships with these two characters.
That's awesome, actually, because up to this point, Gabriel's kind of been a loner.
Redemption is an element that I always shoot for in some ways in my fiction, so it's important to me to have some sort of redemptive element, and it usually just sort of stands up in waves. It's not usually too hard to find. And I don't, I mean, not every story has to have that, but... Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have him in some way altered in a way that is perceived to be better by these interactions, or worse, you know.
Well, one thing that strikes me, and you'd mentioned, again, this was just in passing, but it really caught my attention, was the villa in Britain. Mm-hmm. What if that villa is more than just a piece of property that Gabriel bought when they moved to Britain? Mm-hmm. What if that's something that Nacht led him to? What if this has been a legacy from ancient times, and Nacht has been positioning Gabriel to become, I don't know, king of the vampires? You know, something where, you know, you say up to this point, you know, maybe this was... I'm spitballing here. I'm looking for the
vampires are territorial.
Who are?
The vampires, they're territorial.
Okay.
They mark their territory with people by biting them. They scent mark things, and they fight each other. So they're kind of like cats. I don't think they would have a king.
Okay. Not a king.
So what if it's maybe the villa can be a some kind of holy location that aids in the war against Faerie?
Well, they don't have a war against Faerie.
Okay. But let's back up, you know, 20,000 feet and say, let's say that the villa represents a point of power that the mages, the fairy, and the vampires were not aware of, perhaps, but existed, and maybe Nacht is aware of it, but she's unable to affect it directly. And whoever commands whatever is in this villa, it's a book, it's an orb, it's a whatever, It represents a profound power shift in the world. And maybe even the humans, you know, maybe this is a turning point in your multi-species, multi-supernatural world, where some factor, some element...
Dave is trying to introduce a MacGuffin.
Am I really?
It's your character-driven story.
Okay.
Ignore him.
All right, yes, ignore me. Well, I'm sorry. You're right.
Actually does kind of represent something towards Gabriel's later development, because when they attack it, originally his idea is, no, this is my place. This is my territory. I want to defend it. And in defending it, he loses fabulously. I mean, just terrible, terrible tragedy.
Maybe it was his ancestral home.
Well, and which is one of the reasons why later, you know, in Scent and Shadow, he does not defend shit. You know, he has gotten to the point where he's like, look, I will defend people. I, you know, the only thing I care about and the only thing that lasts are people that I make last. Everything else fades and burns and goes away. So this is kind of where he learns that.
Okay. Well, how about this? Let's say it's Gabriel's ancestral home and there are myths about a fabulous treasure being buried there. And people have been digging in it and rooting around in it for generations trying to find this fabulous treasure. Because one thing that made me curious, when Gabriel goes to Britain, suddenly he's like dealing with people and they've got cash and they've got, you know, prestige or status. What if Gabriel returns to his family villa and he knows where the treasure is and uses that and starts feathering the nest and reconnecting with his human ancestry and with the presence of Paul and a son, and then Isolde comes in, ooh, this is a daughter, and you can start building him up in terms of throwing down roots and caring about things and status and position, and then at the end, you can rip all of that away from him and scar him permanently until he becomes...
Sort of shakes the dust off his feet.
Yeah.
It is kind of like that, but without the previous history of, with the place. Because what he does is he was born almost 200 years before that. So he's making everything up. Who he, you know, his identity, the money he has is from the people he's been killing for the last 150 years because he was making them look like they were robbed. So he's just taking the purses and then he decided, you know, I'm going to need to buy clothes and stuff eventually. So he's been keeping it. So he has quite a bit. It is one of those things where he makes up this identity for himself. He makes up this identity for Paul. They move to this new place. They're setting down roots. He's trying to reconnect with society because he wants to make a somewhat normal life for Paul.
Okay.
He's not good at it because he hasn't been dealing with society for this long. Things have changed. When he was last human, there was a republic. Now there's an empire. You know, I mean, there's been huge sweeping changes in the 150 years that he's kind of been out of things. So there's a lot of that and a lot of him putting down roots and becoming very attached to this place. And then, yeah, it's all ripped away at the end.
Sure. And the crisis point, the transition, the arc for Gabriel is the discovery, you know, and make Paul and Isolde a very important part of that to make the people and the relationships that he has, the real defining element of who he is, not the things around him. You know, that whole crisis. I'd imagine every immortal goes through that point where, holy crap, I'm living forever. I can't do this. and they find a way, some touch point, some touchstone that allows them to sustain. And for Gabriel, it'll be Paul and Isolde.
Yeah, and that's an interesting angle to look at it from. I hadn't thought about making it his story again.
So the way in which he changes is that he is... a more bitter and more rootless character by the end of it than he was at the beginning.
He's not as bitter, mostly because he, through what happens to him, he loses an awful lot of emotions. But he is, he remembers, and it was bad, and he doesn't want that to happen again.
Well, he's trying to be something he's not. Right. He's trying to be human.
Mm-hmm.
There's your thematic for at least him anyway. You know, he immerses himself into human culture for Paul. Mm-hmm. When Paul matures, Paul doesn't want that. Paul, being the young new guy on the block, once he gets past the horror of what he's done and through Isolde and through events that goes in there, you know, Paul can and Isolde can be Gabriel's salvation in that respect. Stop trying to be human. Be a vampire. I need you to be a vampire.
Yeah, you can play the identity crisis thing pretty effectively, I think, with all three of these characters. What's Isolde's arc again? Like, how does she change?
Her arc was she kind of goes from being a complete loner and self-reliant to becoming part of this very strange family and... becoming incredibly close and emotionally tied to and putting her safety and everything in their hands, and their safety and everything's in her hands. It's kind of, her kind of choosing which family she's going to have. Is she going to have the normal, skin shifter family? Is she going to have the, she has a love interest with a human. So is she going to go that route, or is she going to stick with this weird vampire family?
Okay, so the redemptive elements of the story are kind of that even though they walk away from scorched earth, more or less, they walk away together.
Yeah.
Like, you have these three disparate people who come from very different places and have very different identity crises that they're going through, and they end up forming this strange little family that is, that is valid and valuable to them, and they lose everything else that they're trying to gain in the process, but they end with that. So that's powerful. That could
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
So if you're going to do that, I would not start too far from the point when they all three meet. If you start too far in Gabriel and Paul's past, it's going to feel like it's about them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would start pretty close to the point when they all three come together, unless you want to be telling Isolde story separately until she runs into them. Like, you could go all three threads before they meet each other and then pull them gradually.
That's
together.
Actually kind of cool. Isolde could lay down the foundation for the Britain setting, and lay down the power play and the political struggles, because she's a thief moving through the streets. She sees all that, and then Gabriel and Paul move into that, and so the audience has been prepped. That's kind of cool.
And the audience is wondering, the audience can tell, okay, Mercy wouldn't be telling me about this character unless she was going to run into these guys eventually. And so you could sort of set up they're sort of dreading it. They see it coming, like, this can't be good. We like all of these characters. Who's going to explode or die horribly when they finally run into each other?
Guys, yeah. I hate to call time, but the time is ticking down. So let's take one more round around the round table. And get some final words and observations, and just seed some stuff that Mercy can take away with. Abigail, final words for Mercy.
I really like it. I would read it.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm confident in your ability to tell the story even without us. So you know what you're doing.
Yes.
It's really nice to have people to bounce ideas off of and go, you haven't even been considering this idea. What's wrong with you?
Well, that's good. I'm glad we were helpful.
Yeah. Brian, how about you, sir?
If nothing else, we've given you about three different directions to go in. So I don't know if we helped or complicated the issue a little bit more. But no, I think there's just so much really awesome potential for conflict. Even just it's so funny because it it's feeling more and more like a character based story.
Yeah.
But I think that some of the best genre fiction and some of the best vampire stories deal with that sense of humanity, and Gabriel has it, and Paul has it, and even Isolde has it. And so I think whatever you do with this, it's going to be wildly intriguing, and I'm looking forward to what it turns into.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I I agree with Abigail and Paul, or Paul Brian, whatever.
Yeah,
the half-breed on the other side of the table over there.
Whatever your name is, my co-host.
What are you trying to say about me now?
I'm saying that, no, we're not going to go there. This is Mercy's story. With what Brian said, that this as a character-driven story, if that is your central theme, that sustains. And as Brian has affirmed, the relationships between these characters is intriguing enough. They're supernatural origins and those cultures add more intriguement to it. I think if you focus on how these three people draw each other to whatever final apotheosis or transition or breakthrough crisis point that they have, it's going to end up cool. One minor detail thing, you were concerned about the fact that the Fae were going to close down the ether to Isolde and they couldn't get back to the villa in time.
Isolde would be able to get back because she is Fae. She can move through Fae or fairy.
Okay, but Paul couldn't.
Fairy is actually fairly sentient in and of itself,
right.
And it would not let him, it shouldn't let him through.
Okay, so
but York is 200 miles away from London, so right. I'm having a hard time getting him back in any sort of real amount of time.
You have other sources of magic. There is a mage in your story. There is a mage. Yeah, go ahead and sigh and go, but that's impossible. How can I get that mage to actually help in this sense? And that, my dear, is your challenge. You can do it.
There couldn't be mages in the Ninth Legion that he knows who are friends of his that wouldn't help him. It's the physics that's the problem.
Oh, science rears its ugly head. Okay. Well,
give him the ability to borrow a skin, like a raven skin, something. Mm.
Oh.
Ooh, and yeah, maybe
that's cool.
Maybe he shares some of her abilities when they do whatever, as well as the other way around.
Oh, that would make them very angry.
Have Isolde wounded at the battle, not at the villa, but at the battle, and have Gabriel or Paul have to turn her there.
Paul can't turn anyone.
Okay, fine.
But
if she could give him the ability to wear a skin, he could.
Because I was thinking a backwash of magical power as he tries to turn a skinwalker would reflect her powers back on him, blah, blah, blah. But
they're actually, I actually kind of have a method for this, for a story that I haven't written yet. There is a kind of spell that the mages can do that where if you take a skin shifter's skin and you have to get it from them, which they don't really like. there is a way of basically, that's how werewolves are.
Okay.
Werewolves are people who have stolen a skin from someone and done a spell.
There's something that you can work with to
yeah,
fix
that. That's not
that
a bad
problem.
Idea at all.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
That's fabulous. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Before we wrap up, before we close this thing down, Mercy, we always exact a vow from our guest writers that when your book achieves a cult following and people start dressing up as your characters, the major movie deal goes through and they make plushies about your characters, that when you achieve this exalted height that you'll come back to us, let us know so we can plaster your name upon our someday Hall of Fame of successful writers. Will you do this for us?
I will definitely do that, and you guys are all getting a copy when I have it done.
Yes!
Yay!
Awesome! Very cool. Holy crap! What? It's lots of great stuff here. Good mojo, good gold being scattered about. Abby, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing and inspiring and keeping me on track and out of MacGuffinville.
Yes, thank you for that.
Yeah. this has been a real pleasure.
His revenge.
it's been a delight and a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. And
thank you guys all. This has been very, very helpful.
Good, good.
Awesome.
And Mercy, it's never easy putting stories out there for people to kick around, no matter how seasoned a veteran you may be. So we're deeply appreciative of you stepping up and offering this very awesome story for us to chew on for an hour.
Yeah, you also gave us a really, a good story that was well fleshed out and was already a story.
It's very cool.
And I'm sorry that we didn't necessarily get into the blood and guts of it, but I'm sure you'll have a lot of fun with that.
I was going to say,
there's other kinds of dark, though.
Yes, that's true.
And there's always the comments on the post. So, Brian, you can start drafting your magnum opus now.
And way ahead of you.
Very cool.
Brian, I think you're going to like Scent and Shadow. I really do.
Awesome. I'm excited.
He's already there. Wonderful anthology, Hungry for Your Love, an anthology of zombie romance. We're all over
that.
There are some great stories in that.
Oh, God. Friends, thank you so much for joining us for this awesome episode. We certainly had fun. I hope you did, too. Show us some love out at iTunes. Come out to the website and leave a comment. If you've got ideas for Mercy, please drop out there. I'll make sure she's aware of it and we can continue the discussion there. Drop us a line. Show some love. We're out on Twitter at Writers Podcast. Follow us out there and throw some love out that way. Either way, we're looking forward to hearing from you. Brian, any closing words as we fade off into the sunset?
Absolutely. Make sure that you wear your steel collar when you go right.
Good advice, all. So definitely go looking for awesome stuff, guys. You will find it. And stay tuned in a couple of weeks. We'll have another writer, another 20 minutes with, another workshop. The awesomeness just keeps flowing like spice from Arrakis here at the Roundtable Podcast. You worked a Dune theme in on that one, baby. Until next time, you guys take care, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.